My name is Don Hopi. I'm filling in for Ken Ward as moderator on this panel, this coal panel, yet another coal panel at an SEJ conference. We had coal panels at least dating back to Pittsburgh in 2004. We actually toured a coal mine then. We certainly had a coal panel in Roanoke, and the opening plenary touched on coal also. So we're doing a lot of stuff with coal here, and coal's been in the news. Coal ash has been in the news this year, mountaintop mining. It's certainly been a topic in the climate change discussions. Because you're here to listen to our speakers, I'm going to shut up after I them. Except for a few quick announcements, because we really are between a rock and a hard place here, because coal is the rock and the hard place is lunch. We don't want to miss that. I don't have to really identify. Lisa Evans is a staff attorney for Earth Justice. She does a lot of work with coal ash. Jeffrey Homestead is a former EPA assistant administrator for air in the George W. Bush administration, and in the first administration worked on the Clean Air Act amendments. He is currently a partner and head of the Environmental Strategies Group at Bracewell and Giuliani. And Michael Hendricks, all the way at the end, is research director for the Institute for Health Policy at West Virginia University. He's done a lot of work on health effects of coal mining in coal mining areas, not only in West Virginia, but throughout the nation. Each one of them will make a short opening statement, and then we'll take questions. You need to identify yourself when asking a question, and also the organization you're with. We'll take questions from SEJ members first. Please ask a question. Don't make a statement. No filibusters, either from the questioners or from the speakers, I hope. And we'll be able to answer as many questions as possible. So, with that, racing through that, we'll get started with Michael Hendricks first. Michael?
Thank you. Thanks for the introduction. Thanks, everybody, for being here. In addition to my role in the Institute, I am also an associate professor in the Department of Community Medicine, the public health department, essentially at West Virginia University. And the research that I've been doing over the past several years focuses not just on health effects related to miners. In fact, my focus is pretty different. It's on the health effects for community residents or for populations at large, for people that live in mining communities in West Virginia or in Appalachia or across the nation. So I've been doing this research for the past 3 or 4 years now, and what we've been seeing is based primarily on reliance on secondary data sources. So we look at things like CDC mortality rates, some self-report data from some national or state surveys from a variety of sources. And what I'm finding is that consistent with anecdotal evidence about health effects related to living in a mining community, I do find that there is evidence for higher age-adjusted mortality rates for people that live in mining communities compared to people that live in other parts of Appalachia or the nation. These effects are present when you look at all-cause mortality and also for certain forms of chronic disease, including chronic heart disease, respiratory disease, some types of cancer, kidney disease. They are partially accounted for by socioeconomic and behavioral effects, things like higher smoking rates and higher poverty rates. But there seems to be something left over that is not accounted for, and we think that environmental contributions to those disparities is probably part of the picture. There is also evidence that air quality and water quality are both problematic in mining communities, especially in areas of Appalachia. More recently, we've been seeing those same effects for things like poor birth outcomes and some dental health outcomes. And so from my perspective, I approach it from a social disparities model, which is not that just the environmental problems are present, but that we have to look at the whole picture of the economy and the social environment that's present in coal mining areas. Those areas tend to have higher poverty rates, lower income levels, than and higher unemployment rates, surprisingly, compared to areas of Appalachia that don't have mining. So from my perspective, we need to start thinking about development of economic alternatives for mining communities as a public health strategy.
Jeff, you want to go second?
Well, I'm happy to be here. I'm a little out of place on a panel that looks a lot more at some of the waste issues related to coal. And I was told I had the discretion to talk just about the future of coal more generally, so I'll take that opportunity. Some of you I know and dealt with when I was at EPA. As you may or may not know, when I left EPA, I took kind of a one-year sabbatical and went around with my family for a year and visited actually many parts of the world, including time, quite a bit of time in India and China and Indonesia and Mexico. And as you look at the future of coal, I don't think you can do justice to that issue without understanding that the energy challenges faced by those countries. Just a couple of statistics that you've probably heard before or are very well aware of. I think Jim Rogers and Andy Rifkin both mentioned that coal continues to provide about 80% of the power in China, even though, as several people said, they have more solar and more wind than anybody else. They also have a lot more people than anybody else and a whole lot more coal than anyone else. And they're, on average, connecting to their grid a new coal plant every 9 or 10 days, about 750 megawatts. In India, where there is still unbelievable poverty and there are close to a billion people that don't have access to affordable, reliable electricity, they are also dramatically expanding their coal fleet. They announced just in the last few weeks that over the next decade, and again, they're also investing in nuclear. They're also investing to a lesser extent in other technologies. But they are expected to have about five times more electricity generation from coal than they do today. Throughout the Middle East, which has typically relied on oil and natural gas, they're also building new coal plants. In fact, if you look at the total amount of electricity that's produced today, the total, and that is hovering around 50%. The predictions from the International Energy Agency and from EIA and others actually project that, notwithstanding concerns about climate change, the total amount of the pie will increase. That coal is not going to, you know, gradually fade away, that it will continue to increase. Now, why is all of this? And the answer is there is a need for affordable power. And even if you were to go out and install today in the U.S. A coal-fired power plant that has the most expensive, most advanced controls for sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides and mercury and PM and everything else, it is very close to being the cheapest way to produce that power. Again, it depends a little bit on natural gas, and some people will say, well, a combined cycle plant or a nuclear plant, but they're all very close. And if you build anywhere else in the world where you don't have to, and by the way, the Chinese are building good plants with good emission controls, not quite the same level we do in the United States. But the reason they're doing that is because we have not yet figured out a way to produce electricity in a way that's as reliable and as affordable as coal. And so I know that some of us, and I've been doing environmental law since the late 1980s, my insight, and I appreciated very much what Andy Rifkin had to say in the last session, is unless you become very knowledgeable about energy issues, it's very hard to be effective, I think, in covering environmental issues, because there are these underlying pressures. And, you know, in the U.S. they're not as great, but in the rest of the world, and sometimes I have these discussions with people who seem to be critical of the Chinese or the Indians or the Indonesians or the Mexicans, and who say, well, how can they just blithely go on and build more coal plants and emit CO2 emissions? I think that misunderstands the situation. I think they have a moral and political imperative to provide a better life for their people. And so it's very hard for them to voluntarily agree to measures that will increase the energy costs for their people and make it even further, make it even more difficult for them to get out of poverty. I have some more optimistic thoughts too, but I wanted to set the table here. But one of the things I wanted to say is that just kind of the former vice president is a very smart and able man and a very capable speaker. But there was one thing he said that I found quite telling. I don't remember the name of the questioner, but somebody asked him a question about the future of the newspaper industry and whether he thought that Congress would step in and do something. And you were all just there, so you heard this. But what I heard was basically something like, you know, Congress can't just move in and legislate away the problems facing the newspaper industry. There's sort of structural issues that have to be dealt with that you can't just move in and legislate away. And I think it's very much the same with climate change. It is not a failure of law. It is not whether the Congress passes this bill or that bill. We could, at a high cost, we could significantly reduce our emissions. That has competitive issues. It has, economic. It has all those issues that Congressman Sensenbrenner mentioned. But that doesn't really matter very much unless we have a legitimate way to deal with global emissions. And so the idea that the answer to this is just a treaty or legislation, you can't just legislate away the basic problems facing humankind. And I think we do need to be thinking more about, as Andy Revkin said and Congressman Sensenbrenner and others, is this is it's certainly a lifestyle issue, but I think very few people in developed or developing countries are willing to kind of give up the freedoms that you get from cheap transportation and from reliable, affordable electricity. And so it comes down to figuring out a way that doesn't involve fossil fuels that can provide reliable, affordable energy for both electricity and for transportation. So with that by way of background, I think the future of coal is, unless we figure out a new technology to do it as cheaply as we can do today with coal, coal will continue to be used to produce power for the lifetimes of everybody in this room.
Well, first, there are a lot of very interesting competing speakers today at the same time, so I really appreciate your all attendance at this one. Just in a way, a real quick reaction, because I think I heard Jeff say cheap maybe, a half a dozen times at least, and I just think it's up to all of you to look at what are the costs, and are the costs what the kilowatt hours are, or do they include the increased mortality in coal mining villages and the health and cleanup costs at coal ash ponds. To launch into the whole coal ash issue, many of you, I hope, saw 60 Minutes last Sunday. Probably all of you are aware of the huge disaster in Kingston, Tennessee, which really started the national debate. I mean, I've been talking about this for 10 years, but people really started to listen after December 2008, where a six-story dam burst and 1.1 billion gallons of toxic sludge were let loose onto the Kingston, Tennessee community. That cleanup looks like cleanup costs will exceed $1.1 billion. So certainly, I think that needs to be factored into the equation of what is cheap energy, and that doesn't even start to address what might have been the health and environmental costs of that spill. But TVA, I want to emphasize, is just the beginning of the story. This is not an easy story, and it hasn't gotten a lot of coverage because it's not easy, but it is really important. And some of the factors that make it important are it's really necessary to understand what we're talking about in terms of the quantity of waste. Not only the quantity of waste that's generated by coal-fired power plants in the U.S. every year, which is 131 million tons, which is enough waste to put in a train stretching from D.C. to Melbourne. In 5 years, that's going to be 175 million tons because of the scrubbers that are going to be put on coal-fired power plants. So this is a rapidly accelerating volume of waste. But the more scary statistic is how much waste we have generated, U.S. coal-fired power plants has generated in the United States since 1900, since we started burning coal, and that equals 3 billion tons. And that waste is enough to flow over Niagara Falls for 9 days straight. And the problem is that EPA nor the states never regulated that waste, the disposal of that waste, in a safe manner so that its harmful constituents were controlled. And what are the harmful constituents? You know, the other thing about ash is that it, you know, it doesn't look scary. But the most recent draft risk assessment that EPA wrote in 2007 tells us that it is really scary, that the risk to human health from drinking contaminated water from coal ash is off the charts. For example, for a child who lives near an unlined coal ash pond, of which Jim Rogers has at least a dozen from his Duke power plants, a child who's drinking arsenic-tainted water from one of those plants has a 1 in 50 cancer risk. To give you a perspective on how high that risk is, if that same child smoked a pack a day of cigarettes, it wouldn't come close to that 1 in 50. Smoking a pack a day is 1 in 1,000, by the way. The goal that EPA shoots for under the Bush administration is 1 in 100,000. So we're talking about very high risk from scary or toxic constituents such as arsenic, cadmium, chromium, et cetera. So you have a lot of waste, you have a lot of toxicity. What makes this difficult is before the TVA spill, we didn't really know where that ash was. I mean, we know it's in landfills, minefields, waste ponds, fills of any sort, but the location, the quantities was pretty much unknown. After the TVA spill, two important things happened. One was a huge data gathering activity of EPA initiated in March, which bore fruit on the internet. Every major utility now has listed by facility descriptions of all their coal ash ponds. EPA is in the process of inspecting all those ponds. Again, I wish I was able to ask a question of Mr. Rogers. He has, I think, 10 high-hazard coal ash dams, dams which, if they fall, would kill people. Inspections of all those facilities, some of which have already gotten poor ratings, they're all on the web. I have prepared a cheat sheet for people which has the websites of EPA and also links to other important documents, most of which were compiled by EPA. But, you know, again, it is a, you know, it's not all laid out for you. And, you know, until we have another break and you know, eventually we will have another dam, perhaps not as big as TVA, you know, it's, I would hate to think that, you know, we wouldn't have reporting on that issue until then. The second very important thing that followed from the TVA spill is that EPA committed to regulating the waste. EPA is committed to issuing proposed regulations in December of this year. So we're right around the corner. It's likely that they already decided whether they're going to regulate coal ash as a hazardous waste or a non-hazardous waste. Why does it matter? I tell you, all hell's going to break loose if it's a hazardous waste. I mean, we're very much advocating, based on the science, based on the law, that this fits into the category of hazardous waste. But currently, the entire United States generates 28 million tons of hazardous waste a year. You know, again, if you remember back, we generate 131 tons alone of coal combustion waste. So it expands the Resource Conservation Recovery Program, the RCRA program at EPA, you know, by fivefold, sixfold, you know, in a couple of years when all that scrubber sludge comes to bear. So in short, because I know we want to get to questions, but, you know, this is a very, very big issue. It's you've got over 2,000 landfills, minefields, waste ponds, and other receptacles of ash in communities all over the United States. You have documented damage, but it's going to be up to my organization, to scientists, to you, hopefully, to try to dig it out and make people aware and make people realize that if EPA does define this as a hazardous waste and we do finally have federal enforcement and consistent national regulations, you know, that the communities want it because they know about it and they know about the hazard. And I'll just say one last thing is, you know, to show an intersection of this panel is in January, Earth Justice wrote, put out this report, which talks about the disposal of coal ash in mines, which is sort of the ultimate insult to mining communities after they've endured what happens when you mine coal. What the utilities have been doing is coming back and saying, okay, that's a hole, let's put coal ash in it, without liners, without financial assurance, without monitoring. So this has been the final insult. And I'll leave you with a news article from Tennessee this week, where they have suggested, and only Tennessee can do this, they suggested in a mountaintop removal mine that they were going to make that a coal ash dump. So that was kind of, you know, like a dentist putting rock candy into your cavity. But thank you. Thank you. I probably went over.
Thank you very much. I think that we have laid out some issues here, described some of the things that we're looking at in terms of health and also in terms of economics. I guess I'd like to talk, or I get to ask the first question, I guess, and I had a couple, but I'll limit myself just to one, and I'll direct this to Jeff first, and others can chime in if you'd like. There's hundreds of old coal-fired power plants operating right now in the United States. A lot of pollution from those older plants. Some studies show that they emit mercury, SOx, NOx, and CO2 at rates 4 to 10 times modern coal-fired plants, and there's no plans to shut those down anytime soon. What kind of future do they have as we move into controlling these emissions, hopefully, and also with regard to reducing greenhouse gases nationwide and worldwide? What are they going to do?
Well, I'm trying to think the best place to start without filibustering here. Yeah. The emissions of normal pollutants from those plants have been coming down for years. And again, that's been kind of a bipartisan effort that has taken place since the 77 amendments, and then it really accelerated with the 90 amendments. And so throughout, really especially since 1990, all of the pollution, all of the conventional pollution, whether you're talking SO2 or NOx or mercury, has come down, will continue to come down. It's been interrupted by a court case that overturned a rule that we worked on when I was there that was very important, but still, so the conventional pollutants are coming down. The bigger question has to do with CO2, and as everybody here knows, CO2 is just very different. In fact, all of these other pollution controls that have been installed under the Clean Air Act since 1977 are increasing CO2 emissions because it sometimes actually converts the other pollutants into gases that include CO2, and in all cases it reduces the efficiency of the plant. So there is this... It's a fundamental challenge, and the only real options that we have for reducing CO2 are carbon capture and storage, CCS, that I suspect we may talk more about, or making the plants more efficient, or in some cases people have suggested co-firing with biomass could get you some marginal reductions. And really much of the discussion on Capitol Hill and at EPA is, well, what do you do to reduce CO2 from the existing coal-fired power plants? And, you know, people who cover environmental issues tend to say, well, these are the biggest pollution sources. Well, that's true. They also generate 50% of the electricity we have in the country. And so it's an energy issue and an environmental issue. And one of the things that I know Mr. Rogers and others have talked about is some sort of a schedule that would allow you to transition away from these plants that again, we can talk about, you know, what the true cost of coal is and all of the other things, but in terms of actual economic costs, these plants produce power very inexpensively, even when you have to put on emission controls. So and one of the big problems with regulating CO2 under the Clean Air Act is the Clean Air Act is designed and it has dozens of programs, all of them which are designed to get people to install good pollution controls, whether it's a new plant or an existing plant. But there are no pollution controls that you can bolt onto your coal-fired power plant. You can make it a little more efficient. There is some possibility in some parts of the country that you may be able to eventually do carbon capture and storage, but that's quite expensive and not being done anywhere yet. And so, the bottom line is when it comes to conventional pollutants, I think we are certainly moving in the right direction, and those will continue to be reduced over time. The real question is, what do you do on the CO2 side? And that's just a much, much bigger question. Now, one last observation, and then I'll turn the floor over. If you look at all the analyses that have been done of the various legislative proposals, whether you're talking Waxman-Markey or Boxer, Kerry, or any of the prior bills, they all show that most of the CO2 reductions come over the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years under that legislation, because the biggest reductions in CO2 emissions come from new nuclear plants and from new coal-fired power plants with CCS. You have a little bit of wind. You have almost no solar because they're super expensive. You do have some efficiency gains in terms of end-use efficiency, but we're really depending much more on these technologies that are at least on the horizon, but are very, very difficult to permit. And so at the same time that this legislation requires that we kind of phase out these older plants and put in new plants, it doesn't do anything to make the siting of these new plants any easier. And so, today there has been around the country people who have proposed CCS projects that have been unable to get permits for those projects because of Endangered Species Act concerns or NEPA concerns or other things. Same with nuclear plants. And so I guess part of my message as someone who spends a whole career on the intersection between energy and environment is if we do have legislation, and we're not going to have it by the end of the year despite Mr. Gore's prognostication to the contrary, I think we may have it eventually. But it does need to address some of these underlying issues, because without the ability to actually permit and install CCS, without the ability to build quite a few new nuclear plants, and again, I'm not talking about whether they should be subsidized or any of that stuff, just the licensing and the siting process, you're going to have some real problems.
Anyone else want to take a shot?
Yeah, I would like to add a comment to that. One of the reasons that the conventional pollutants are lower out of coal-fired power plants than they used to be is because the cleaning process is becoming more stringent at the processing plants nearer to the coal mines and the people that live there. When you remove arsenic or mercury from coal, it doesn't magically disappear from the world. It still exists. It ends up being deposited in local environments and impacting the people that live there. So I don't think we should minimize those. To me, they're still vitally important, and we have to figure out better ways to process coal and to keep the contaminants that result from coming into human contact. Secondly, even though those emissions are going down, coal power is still higher in those emissions than any other source that we use and is responsible for thousands of deaths every year.
Another problem when you're talking about old plants is you're more likely at an old plant to have an old pond or an old landfill or an old mine fill where there aren't any controls. So we're really hoping that EPA realizes that when it comes out with its regulations in December and addresses the corrective action or the remediation cleanup that needs to be done at those old units, because as well as those old plants creating more air pollution, they're likely polluting the water in a much greater way than a new plant. And what needs to be done, and we're hoping EPA will take that strong position, is that these unlined waste ponds just have to be phased out. They've been shown to be too dangerous, both because of cataclysmic failure and their propensity to leach into the underlying groundwater. So I think that you know, may put a burden on old plants that will, you know, turn the tide or change the economic dynamics. But we'll have to see.
Okay, let's open it up for questions. Remember, SEJ members and working journalists first. And please state your name and your affiliation. Okay, the question is full cost accounting for coal and how?
Well, I'll answer quickly because my answer, I'm not quite sure what that would mean. You're talking about trying to account for
the
externalities. I think it's very important that we do that. I can tell you, as someone who spent 5 years at EPA, trying to put monetary values on a lot of these things is very difficult and very controversial. And so my guess is that would be a useful academic exercise. But one of the problems that you have, and again this was alluded to I think in the earlier panel today, is people tend to see what they want to see in those data. And so what some might say is full cost accounting would be viewed by other people as, an activist effort to try to shut down coal plants. And they both would have, you know, scientific studies to back them up. So, but in theory, I think that's absolutely the way we need to do it, is to try to understand the externalities of all of these things. And but the other thing, you know, that it is also, you know, absolutely clear that affordable, reliable power provides huge benefits to society. Now, does that I mean? That's something that needs to be part of this whole exercise. And so, you know, if you're talking full cost accounting, you'd have to look at, I think, all the generating technologies. And then you'd also perhaps need to weigh that against the benefits that you get from having, you know, air conditioning and electricity for all kinds of other things. But in theory, I think it's I think even having that conversation would be a good way to go about it.
Yeah, I agree that it's a very difficult question to try to come up with a full account of all the different costs that might be involved. The environmental costs in particular, I think, would be pretty tough to try to estimate. There is some techniques that I've used to try to estimate the human health part of the equation, and it's not the whole picture, but it's a way to estimate value of human life using standards that are accepted by the federal government and, in fact, are required by things by agencies such as the EPA and others. When they try to make cost-benefit decisions about policies called value of statistical life, and if you can estimate the number of lives that are lost from pollution or from other factors, you can at least assign that piece of the cost puzzle to it. We did that in looking at the economic benefits of the coal mining industry in Appalachia compared to its cost in terms of excess mortality, and estimated that the benefits of the industry in 2005 dollars were a little over $8 billion. And that the costs were over five times higher, just in terms of the human life costs, over $42 billion. So I think that part of it is more than just an academic exercise. That part of it is used by federal agencies in making real decisions. And if we try to do the same thing to the estimates of the number of lives that are lost every year from pollution from coal-fired power plants, that could be a part of the puzzle as well. That could be used to try to come up with a truer cost. There's also been some early efforts to try to estimate the economic value of natural resources. How much is a tree worth when you don't cut it down? How much is a stream worth when you leave it to do what it does naturally? And some rough estimates of that are that the value of the world's ecosystems is higher than the entire combined value of the conventional economy. So I think it is an important activity to try to undertake, and as was stated before, coal is cheap because we fail to incorporate those costs. How we do that in a way that is actually reflected in the prices, I think, is a difficult problem and remains to be seen. But if you look at and alternatives, maybe those would be cheaper if the full costs were brought on board. One final comment. The government of Ontario recently conducted an analysis of the health care costs related to exposure to particulate matter and pollution from coal-fired power in the province of Ontario, and decided to transition away from coal because the costs that they were having to pay in excess health care costs exceeded the benefits, and they are transitioning now to alternatives and are going to stop using coal eventually because of the costs that they have to pay.
Just a quick follow-up question, though, and I think this points out, and I'm not taking issue with any of that, but your study of Appalachia suggests that the coal mining industry in Appalachia should just be shut down, that the costs are so much higher, if it's five times higher than the benefits, and yet it seems like people are not, people who live there, who are employed in the mines and the industry, are not persuaded by that. Why that does seem to be the lesson of this, and again, that's why I think, you know, it's a useful exercise, but I think there's a lot of people who just don't believe it.
Well, if you're one of the few people that's lucky enough to still have a job in the industry, then sure, you want to keep it. You're desperate to keep it because there aren't that many jobs and that much opportunity in those areas anymore. The number of coal mining jobs in Appalachia has declined from 122,000 to about 55,000 in a 20-year period. There aren't that many jobs, and if you're trying to put bread on the table and feed your family, you're darn right you're going to fight for that job because there aren't that many to be had. And I would never suggest that we should simply shut down the coal mining industry today. That obviously would not be the way to go. But what we have to get serious about and what we haven't done yet is developing economic alternatives for the people that live there so they're not dependent on an industry that has a declining number of jobs and that has huge opportunity costs. Because if you've ever been in any of these little southern West Virginia coal mining towns and you see how impoverished they are and with the little opportunity that exists, and you know that no other business is going to want to go there. We have to transition to other opportunities to create more jobs, and we have to do it at the same time that we invest in education. I think investments in basic education and in economic diversification is critical for the Appalachian region, and we should do it right now. Not that we should shut down the coal industry in the meantime, but we have to transition right now.
And I don't think I can add much more to what Michael has said, and I thought he said it very well, except that we are in the process of looking at a full cost-benefit analysis, taking into consideration the health and environmental impacts of coal combustion waste. A think tank out of NYU recently put out a publication called No More Excuses, which is available on the web, and they did a first shot at what are the benefits of regulating coal combustion waste, you know, far outweigh the costs, some of which is based on the spill and the cost of cleanup in Kingston.
Peter Fairley? So the question is coal or carbon capture and sequestration, the economic basis for deciding whether or not it works or can be economically feasible?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I agree with the premise of your question. You know, I've been doing this pretty carefully since the late 1980s. There were certainly indications let me go back and say this. In 1990, when the Air Act amendments were passed, there were many, many coal-fired power plants that already had scrubbers in place. Now, people argued that it would be too expensive to put I'm talking about FGDs, wet scrubbers. And that was really what people thought would happen under the acid rain program. And that was designed as a way to get people to install that pollution control technology. When the NOx-SIP call came along, virtually all new plants were built with SCR, selective catalytic reduction, for NOx. And so that was a technology that was widely used throughout the world. On kind of the older fleet of coal-fired power plants in the Midwest, those were not by and large installed. There were certainly lots of arguments about how costly they would be. Scrubbers have turned out to be less expensive than predicted. SCRs have turned out to be more expensive than predicted. But it has worked, and it has driven up the cost of electricity by a relatively small amount. Today in the world, there's not a single coal-fired power plant that has CCS. Will the technology come along? There are some people who are optimistic. I've been involved in a couple of power projects where the developer has actually gone out and done a full engineering analysis and gotten bids. And I think it can be done today if you're willing to add 30% or 40% to the cost of the plant, and unless you have a cap and trade scheme or something else, there's no one. If you did it today, and you got and it took roughly 20% and 30% of the power that you produce to condense and capture your CO2, and then plus the capital costs of the condenser and everything else. I think it is technologically feasible. I think we will get there in the next few years. Although DOE is estimating maybe 10 years before it's commercially available. But as I say, it will start to happen, and I predict that we will see in the next decade, you will see some full-size power plants, and the cost will probably start to come down. But we're talking about orders of magnitude different costs than what we have for traditional pollution controls. Because one of the big issues is the other pollution controls convert emissions into something else, either through a catalyst or, it captures in a scrubber. What we're talking about here is capturing millions of tons of CO2 and condensing into a form that can be, stored indefinitely in geological formations. I think that can happen, but let's not just blithely say, well, in the past they said it was too expensive and now they've done it, and so this time, they say it's expensive and they'll do it again. Well, I think they, they're probably both perspectives are right, but I don't know of anybody who's in the engineering world who minimizes the cost. Whereas back in the 1980s, 1990s, you had many people saying, look, this is what we're doing today with FGDs, with SCRs. This is what the costs are. We can actually put it in our models and have a fair amount of reliability on it.
Joe Davis. I write for SCJ, SCJ member. I want to challenge you once more to answer the question about full cost accounting. And let's rephrase it as fuller cost. I felt that you kind of waved it away rather blithely as an academic dream. But in fact, how things like flue gas desulfurization is a way of moving the cost from society back onto the coal burning utility. Same with coal ash disposal, another example. And carbon permits are a way of doing this too, regardless of the feasibility of CCS. So there are all these mechanisms that would reallocate part of the cost of coal burning back onto the utility. And it seems to me that the industry position is pretty much to lobby against all of them. Isn't your position kind of dismissive of the idea of reallocating costs there are all these concrete specific mechanisms for doing it that you oppose? Each one of them has a value.
Yeah, but just a second. First of all, I I, in my former position at EPA, I was responsible for imposing more costs on the industry than any other single person. I mean, we adopted regulations because we found, especially on the FGD side, that was a good deal for society and was affordable. So I'm not a.
What percent of plants today of the total fleet have FGD?
I don't know it today.
It's about 50%.
But it's about 50%, and it's growing, and it would be growing faster if the DC circuit hadn't surprised everybody and caused a. So look, I agree. You know, my background is in economics. We ought to figure out a way to force people to internalize those costs. But the other thing that you can't, that I think you can't just be too glib about is, it's not as though those costs are borne entirely by some nameless, faceless company, right? I mean, those costs are paid for by society. Right now, society is not paying a cost for the CO2 that's been going into the atmosphere for the last 100 years, from everybody who drives a car and everybody who turns on a light switch. And so it's not just coal-fired power plants that benefit from the lack of a carbon price. It's society as a whole. We have cheaper electricity than we would otherwise have to have if we were to out. And so one of the questions is just, are we kind of as a society, and not just in the U.S., but worldwide, are we willing to pay a lot more for our energy to reduce the risk of climate change? And I'm not saying whether we should or whether we shouldn't and what the right price is. And Jim Rogers said that they have an internal cost of CO2. I'd be curious. I wish someone would have asked him what that number was. But so, you know, I think it's a mistake to say, well, you know, the bad guys are the coal-fired power plants and they're emitting all of this. You know, we're all the beneficiaries of that. And the industries who buy their power and who produce jobs. So, you know, do we need to do a better job at doing all this? Absolutely. But let's not just be foolish and say it's an us against them. The question is, we all use electricity. We all use, you know, fuel for transportation. What is the best way to do that in a way that accounts for all of these costs?
And aren't you accounting for the benefits to society from the electricity without accounting for the cost to society from the health care that might result?
I don't think it's so much a health care cost. I think it, you know, when you talk about the benefits that we're talking about, it really is avoided mortality and other things. It's, people confuse, you know, actual healthcare savings with these benefits estimates. But you're right. I mean, collectively we benefit, collectively we pay. And the question is, do we pay because we all live in a world that has higher on average temperatures? I mean, that would be a cost that would be imposed on us. Or do we pay by increasing the cost of the power that we use?
Other people's costs are academic. Your costs are not academic.
No, but they're your costs too. Do you use electricity? Do you drive a car? All of us in here pay those costs. And we all, now there are distributional issues, and I think that's But simply to say, well, you know, we get the benefits and we're imposing costs on everybody else, I think is a little bit oversimplified. I agree that there are distributional issues, no doubt about it. But again, this is not just an issue in the U.S. because, as I said before, and I think this is borne out by any number of studies, even if we were to pass Waxman-Markey tomorrow, it would have essentially no impact on predicted climate change using the various models that everybody uses. And so one of the reasons to pass it is because some people believe that that's the best way to get the rest of the world to go along with us. So, you know, there are costs and there are benefits, and the distributional aspects are very difficult because, unlike SO2 and NOx, it really is a global issue.
If we can break this down a little bit, because I find that the discussion is going off into, these generalities, which I'm having a hard time understanding. One statement in particular, you'd say this is a question of mortality and not healthcare, and I don't see how you can say that if you could explain why asthma rates would not be a healthcare issue and a very troubling and expensive one. heart attacks. I mean, I could go on and on. I mean, if you're talking about air pollution and pollution in your water, you know, we're talking about far more than sort of this statistical, you know, the offset statistic where you take a couple of years off people's lives, you know, which people can't.
I don't mean to be
glib.
We spent a lot of time looking at this when I was at EPA, and we looked at the benefits of all the reductions that we got from various regulatory programs. And you're right that you do get some reduction in healthcare costs, and we quantified all those. And so you do get reduced numbers of visits to the emergency room, and you do get reduced numbers of but that represented something like 2 or 3% of the benefits. The vast majority of the benefits you got because of our estimates that you would be that you would be extending people's lives. And again, I don't want to minimize that. And the reason it has such a high number, it's the most important thing. But people, and especially in their reporting, need to make a distinction between, you know, saving health care costs and the benefits that you get by avoided mortality. That's my only. So are there reduced health care costs when you control emissions from power plants? I think there are. But if you look at the societal benefits, that's a very small part of it.
Michael, you probably have.
He's right in the sense that if you compare the comparative costs of health care versus the comparative costs of premature mortality, that the costs that we assign to the value of life in terms of premature mortality far outweigh the extra costs associated with health care. But I don't understand why that's important. Do we value human life or do we not? There are thousands of extra deaths every year that are related to our continued reliance on coal, and those costs are not figured into the price we pay when we pay our monthly bill.
I agree with that.
I personally live in an area where I'm exposed to these things, and I'm not interested in dying prematurely so that somebody's electricity bill is cheap. And we need to incorporate those costs. To me, the whole healthcare thing misses the boat. Even the climate change misses the boat. I'm not concerned about levels of CO2 right now. I'm concerned about the fact that about 10,000 extra people in Appalachia die every year because they live in a coal mining area. Those value that has life, that life has value, and that value is not incorporated yet into the price of coal or the price of the energy or the electricity that we use.
Okay, the question concerns coal ash waste and what the arguments are against not regulating it as a hazardous waste.
Well, we actually were here 10 years ago. In 2000, the Clinton administration made a determination that the waste was hazardous, published that on the Internet in an unsigned decision by Carol Bronner. And within 45 days, the lobbyists had turned it around, even under the Clinton administration. So this, you know, science should play the role in determining what the decision is. You know, RCRA looks foremost at the harm or the potential for harm of a particular substance. And in that, there's a whole list of factors by which you determine whether a waste is hazardous. You know, legally and scientifically, coal combustion waste certainly falls under that because of the quantity, the history of mismanagement, the potential, and this is probably the most important, the potential to leach the harmful constituents. I mean, because of the success Jeff had at EPA clamping down on what is emitted into the air, that has gone into the waste. And so you have these harmful constituents in the waste, the trace elements, and then when they are exposed to water, they come out into the water. So you have to close that gap, you know, in terms of regulating this waste as hazardous. Jackson has stated that she will look at the science of, you know, the chemistry of the waste, the characterization, the way it's disposed, the quantity, et cetera, that she will look at those factors. Her scientists in the, scientists under the Bush administration had been diligently working in the Office of Research and Development to characterize coal ash to determine what changes these increased air pollution control measures, what changes they made to the ash and how that affected the propensity of the hazardous constituents to leach out of the ash. They looked at mercury, they looked at arsenic, selenium, and the whole host of worker metals. And certainly, you know, if anybody looks at those reports, it is, 100% defensible, you know, looking at it from a science perspective, that this needs to be regulated as hazardous. Now, as much as EPA wants to say that that's the basis on which they're going to make the decision, I think economics will come into play. You know, we've got people at the Office of Management and Budget, even under the Obama administration, that are very concerned about cost-benefit analysis. Mr. Sussman, I'm very curious to see how he'll look at this rule, which really is a watershed change to the universe of waste regulated under the Resource Conservation Recovery Act.
What would the additional from health protection be? This is not my area, so I don't have any.
Right, and I'm sorry, that was the second part of the question.
If it's a solid waste versus a hazardous waste, how much better protected would people be?
You know, the regulations themselves, could be exactly the same. Because a hazardous waste is a non-hazardous waste, doesn't mean that EPA can't write guidelines that would be exactly the same as what would be under hazardous waste. The critical difference is that because of the way RCRA was written, when you regulate a waste as a solid waste and not a hazardous waste, EPA only has authority to issue guidelines. These are a set of guidelines that would instruct the states on how they should regulate coal ash. But the history of decades of the lack of control over the waste in the states and the power that the utility industry has had in the state houses of individual states has prevented states from implementing, you know, these kind of rules so far. So the act of EPA saying, this is really how you should do it, states, we feel will have very little effect. The one caveat to that is those federal guidelines would be enforceable by citizen suit against utilities, but that's been a very weak tool. There's just not enough of lawyers at Justice or any of the other nonprofits or citizen groups to take their own actions. It really has to be a program that's federally enforceable and consistent. You know, you've got wildly different laws in Indiana versus Wisconsin right next to each other. And, you know, it shows up in how the waste is handled. So what you really need is, you know, to level the playing field, have consistent laws throughout Appalachia, the Midwest, Southeast, and cure these problems for everybody and so all communities are protected. And that really can only be done if EPA calls it a hazardous waste. Just a real quick laundry list of what you get under hazardous that you don't get under non-hazardous is you get federal enforcement authority, you get federal inspection authority, you get the requirement that companies would have to identify all their past disposal areas, and you get the requirement that states have to have the consistent programs.
In the back? Viable alternative to coal-fired electricity, we would want to pursue it. The viability
And the question?
The question is, what is the trend from a regulatory standpoint and also from a financial standpoint of the willingness to invest in new coal-fired technology?
Okay, can anybody talk to that point, the trend toward investment in new coal-fired technologies?
There was a period when natural gas prices were very low, when there was very little investment in new coal-fired technology, and that really went from 1990 to the early 2000s, when natural gas prices were low and virtually all of the new power was. And again, I don't mean to be dismissive of the renewables, but they really have not made much of an impact in terms of the total generation mix. So we've seen a lot of natural gas. When natural gas spiked up, there was this interest for 5 or 6 years in trying to get a lot of new coal-fired power plants, in part just because you have a lot better... You have a lot better predictability over fuel supply and other things. In the U.S. right now, there's no doubt that that's slowed down. I mean, there's still coal-fired power plants being built, but not at the rate that that you would have guessed 5 or 6 years ago. Where you're not really seeing any change is on the worldwide scene, where, if anything, construction of new coal-fired power plants is increasing. So, as I said, in the Middle East, whereas for years they produce most of their power with oil and natural gas, they're going very significantly to coal just for economic reasons. The Chinese are, currently at 80% of their total generation is coal. They are growing. Their economy is growing at about 8% a year, and their energy consumption is also growing at about 8% a year. And now, of that new growth, coal is still roughly 80%, but maybe slightly less. So worldwide, it is certainly true that the environmental movement is much stronger in the U.S. You've got, very well-funded groups who are fighting every new coal-fired power plant under the Clean Air Act and the Endangered Species Act and NEPA and various other things. And so that is having some effect in the United States. But worldwide, I think the growth of coal-fired power is probably expanding at maybe even a faster rate. And as I said before, if you look at the total percentage of power generated by coal versus other things, that has been growing and is likely to continue to grow, in part because large-scale hydro, is where you have good resources, is by far the least expensive. Is a better way to do it, but there's not a lot of good large-scale hydro that's still available out there. So people have kind of used up those opportunities and going to other things.
Just real quickly, positive trend or positive outcome from the TVA disasters. TVA itself has looked at the management of waste in ponds as too dangerous and too expensive, looking at the cleanup bill that they have for the Kingston site. So they have announced that they're moving towards closing all of their ponds and going towards dry disposal of the waste. So, there's one... fairly small indication of costs affecting the environmental decisions of the plants, but generally I think until you have the subsidies taken away, which we hope will happen with the waste law that will come out in December, until you remove the subsidies from coal, it's going to be really hard to get either movement in the U.S. or internationally.
Yes, Joe Scheffler from the University of Wisconsin. In regards to the regulation of coal combustion byproducts, in Wisconsin, we utilize or reuse coal combustion waste quite a bit in highway construction, bridge construction, sometimes even building construction. How would a change in regulation affect the reuse of coal combustion byproducts?
So the question is, how would the change in regulation for coal ash affect reuse policies?
Well, we hope that for safer uses, and I think Wisconsin has done a pretty good job of doing focusing on the safer uses rather than the bogus uses such as mine filling. For the safer uses, the regulation should provide a really strong incentive, because what it'll do is it'll increase the cost of disposal, and it should provide an incentive for more companies to look to safely recycle the waste. One thing that Wisconsin has been doing a lot of is putting the waste, using the waste as a substitute for Portland cement. What we hope the regulations will do, which have been they've done with other RCRA hazardous waste, is when define what is safe for use and then take them entirely out of the waste stream. So in other words, when you use coal combustion waste as a substitute for Portland cement or in engineered fills in a way that's environmentally safe, that product, coal combustion byproduct that you're calling it, will be that. It will not be hazardous waste. It will be a coal combustion byproduct, and it will be able to be used in commerce as a substitute for other materials. It's going to take a little getting used to. You know, I don't say this, that that's the, I know businesses are in states are a little bit uncomfortable with that initially, but I think it's been done before with other ways, and I think they'll get used to it. You know, we're very interested in preserving the beneficial reuse market where those uses are safe. We don't want to see more stuff in landfills where it doesn't need to go if it can be you know, used as a safe product. So I think they can do both. And I think that, again, the increased disposal cost should, you know, across the country should provide a powerful incentive. You know, if it costs $3 or not, $3 a ton, which is an average cost for disposing in a pond or, you know, or in a mine, there's not much incentive to recycle. So.
Okay. I guess this is just about. I want to ask one last question, though. We've been hearing a lot about the economics of doing different things with our energy production, and especially from Jeff. And I just I guess I wanted to say, given what scientists are saying about climate change, and given the dominant position of the coal industry in the production of our energy, what responsibility does the industry, the coal industry and the American utility industry, have in taking a leadership role here in figuring out a way to reduce emissions rather than just protect what they have and what's been going on? I guess I could also ask the same question a different way. The $40 million clean coal ad campaign, when is that going to go beyond the ad campaign and actually produce a clean coal technology?
Well, it sounds like that question was directed primarily at me, so I'll take it. You know, I don't speak for the utility industry as a whole. I mean, I certainly have clients in that industry. And I can tell you that all of the companies that we deal with would like to have a predictable path toward a much lower carbon technology in the future. There are skepticisms about the proposals that are on Capitol Hill thus far. And I know the environmental groups in large part say they don't go far enough, fast enough, and you heard that from Vice President Gore. Their concern is that especially in the early years, they just don't see a technology path that allows them to do that. And quite honestly, they're also concerned, especially utilities in the Southwest and in the in the Midwest, that a lot of their customers just go away, because if the transition is fast enough that costs go up quickly, you know, a lot of their energy is so, especially, you know, heavy industry in the U.S. is not distributed equally. There's not much in New England anymore. There's not much in California, in large part because energy costs are much higher there, and so you tend to have heavy manufacturing in areas where the energy cost is lower, and you know my clients are concerned that if the costs go up very quickly, and especially if cheap energy remains available in other parts of the world, that their customers will have no choice but to go somewhere else. So Again, I think Jim Rogers is not unique. He's a little more outspoken, and he would support, I believe, a reasonable cap and trade bill or a carbon tax, which my clients don't necessarily support, but which I think is a much kind of fairer, more predictable way to go about doing it. And so I think that you really do have most energy companies who are engaged in the debate as to how we get to there from here, and the question is, you know, how do you do it when the kind of the technologies that are available are so constrained at this point. And so it's not, you know, my clients are not negative on renewables. They're spending a lot of money on renewables, but they're saying it just doesn't work for baseload power. And they're looking at nuclear. That obviously has a very long lead time and has other issues associated with it. So they're spending a lot of time and effort, not just lobbying on Capitol Hill, but actually putting money into these projects. And I think all of the clients we work for are looking at CCS, either on their own plants or as part of a joint venture. They're looking at some of these algae pond ideas where you could actually take the CO2 and pipe it into a pond and then, you know, use that for a liquid fuel. It's very easy to say, well, we need to reduce emissions by 40% by 2020 and by 90% by 2050. But actually figuring out how to do it is a much bigger challenge. And I think there is a legitimate concern about, and Congressman Sensenbrenner said this, if all we do is move, you know, industry from here to other places, we've done something that's economically damaging to the U.S. and does very little, if anything, for the environment. And you know, the truth is, even with higher energy prices, some manufacturers would stay here, but many would have no choice but to go overseas. And people have talked about, you know, these, you know, kind of a border tax or a tariff to offset those. It still doesn't help very much, because that only helps you if all of your customers are in the U.S. If you're competing on the international marketplace and you want to sell your fertilizer or your chemicals or your steel outside the United States, it doesn't help if you've got these feed-in tariffs at the border or something of that sort. So it's, I mean, the problem here is there is no easy answer.
At the risk of sounding like somebody who went to school on this campus 40 years ago, I just have a real distrust of that argument, Jeff, because working on the waste issue, we don't have unclear solutions, and there aren't complicated technological fixes that we're waiting to happen. I mean, safe waste disposal is a 19th century technology. You know, you line a landfill, you keep it away from water, and you put a cap on top of it. And you monitor to make sure nothing comes out. You know, it's not even expensive. It hasn't been expensive for 50 years. And the industry, until they were caught red-handed and are being made to do it, wouldn't do it. So when I hear the arguments that it's too complicated, we're not there yet, we really want to, but, you know, we're not sure, you know, I'm sorry,
we're talking past each other, because I on the waste side, you may very well be right. I don't know very much about the history of that, but I can...
I wanted to hear,
but I was going to say, let's talk. Okay, I was planning to. I just wanted to make sure that she acknowledged that there was a difference between.
But we're hiding whether it's an assessment of cost and cost benefit or an assessment of technology. You know, your arguments do go towards it's very, you know, it's too complicated. But when you look at what's happening in the world, whether it's the impacts of global warming, the mortality, the contamination of drinking water, we can't hide behind that anymore, and we can't keep disagreeing over these terms, and we can't keep discussing this as if it's an academic problem. You know, it's the sustainability of our world, and if we have to learn how to have much more expensive energy, so be it. But, you know, it's just I feel that in the absence of pushback, we would just have the status quo until we have an EPA or Congress is willing to really crack down, and I'm afraid that's going to take way too long. If the TVA dam hadn't fallen down, I wouldn't be here. You know, and so, you know, let's not have another tragedy in the world that will, you know, get everybody together and say, okay, now we have to do something about it, because I'm just afraid that'll be too late.
Michael, Wes.
I guess just in general, just agreeing with what Lisa had to say, that not to discount the fact that it is a global issue, and I think you raise an important point that the United States is in a very different place than other parts of the world, and China and India aren't going to necessarily do what we want them to do. To me, though, that doesn't excuse us from doing whatever we can to improve our own energy picture and do the investments that are necessary to come up with a renewable energy sources for ourselves. One of the things that we haven't really discussed yet at all, and I'll just mention it briefly, is the supplies of coal that we have left in the United States. In Appalachia, the coal industry will like to tell you that there's hundreds of years left and we can keep mining at current levels, and that's simply not the case. Many places in Appalachia have already passed peak production. The only places that have not are eastern Kentucky and West Virginia, and they're probably going to pass peak production in less than 20 years. There's more in other parts of the country, in Wyoming and other places. But we have to start transitioning to a different type of sustainable, renewable energy right away for lots of different reasons, CO2 being one of them, limited supplies being another, health impacts being another. And if the world doesn't come along with us, then we only have a limited capacity to control that, but we still have to do what we need to do here. And if that means the economy picture changes and some jobs go overseas, other jobs will come to take their place. If you have a population that's healthier, that population is going to be more economically vibrant, and there can be alternatives that develop. If you compare the coal mining areas in West Virginia to those parts of the state that do not have coal, those parts that do not have coal, even though they're similar in many other respects, topographically and demographically and so on, have stronger economies. They've developed alternatives, and we can do that here as well.
Well, thank our panelists, please. It's lunchtime. I thank Ken Ward for putting this panel together, and thanks for sitting through it. Thanks.